Everyone's asleep.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand. And my very special guest today is none other than Rick Osmond. Rick, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Vinnie. How you been?
You know, somewhat fabulous is my standard response, mate. What about yourself?
I'm well, and that's an accomplishment all by itself.
Yeah, it can be, especially when everybody's bathing in that Fukushima radiation. Which is everybody at this point. Now, Rick, would you please be so kind as to explain to myself and the audience just a little bit about yourself and what it is you do?
Well, I'm an author, a magazine writer. I've been a talk show host myself off and on for the last 8 or 9 years. For the Oopa Loopa Cafe, as well as Unraveling the Secrets, and regular on 2 or 3 other shows. But I'm concentrating now on my research that is still growing out of my book, The Graves of the Golden Bear, Ancient Fortresses and Monuments of the Ohio Valley. I don't know how familiar or how far-reaching your audience is, but how familiar they are with North America, but the Ohio Valley and the Mississippi together drain about 2/3 of the United States. So there were a lot
kind
of
like the kind of like the Congress and its expenditure.
Yeah, they drain about 2/3 of everything. That's right. But the drainage basin of those rivers has been the highway system for North America for pretty much as long as there have been people here. However long that is, and the Clovis First argument is dying a slow and agonizing death, because we now have verified dates going back 14, 15, 16, 18, 25,000 years, and a few anomalies that indicate anywhere from 100,000 to 200,000 years. So there have been people around here for a very long time.
We're talking about ancient civilizations and things of that nature. I've interviewed a number of people who talk about Bigfoot and what have you, other primitive creatures waltzing around that people still haven't discovered yet.
They haven't recognized them as a scientifically verified entity, but yeah, they're there, some of them.
Even a former president of the United States, somebody wrote a book, a journal entry or something of this nature, that they were attacked by a group of these creatures. They were surrounded by red eyes looking at them from out of the bush somewhere in Northern California. I forget who it was. It might have been
Teddy Roosevelt.
Teddy Roosevelt, yeah.
Yeah, and he did not exactly, well, he did have an encounter of his own, but it wasn't, he was relating the account of the attack. And it was in front of a number of, well, high echelon folks, I guess is how you'd have to say it. It was rather interesting, to say the least. And we've had other high officials who have offered anomalous observations. Jimmy Carter claimed to have seen a UFO. You know, President Obama claims to have a Social Security number. Another, you know, a lot of anomalous stuff like that. My research is a little older than most of that. I'm actually into some of the strange history of the very early United States. And in my book, I concentrate the first three or four or five chapters are about the founding of the colonies in North America, not just by the English, but also by the Spanish and the French, with a high concentration on the French, because they recorded a lot of anomalous things. And a lot of their records actually contain what I perceive to be coded messages. In particular, there's one map by a guy by the name of Delisle, who was the cartographer, geographer royal for King Louis, actually for the regent at that time, because Louis wasn't old enough to, you know, the Dauphine, he wasn't old enough to be king. So they had a regent, but he was preparing and educating the heir to the throne on the geography of the French realm, including New France and what at that time was known as La Louisiane, what we later call the Louisiana Territory here in the United States. But some of his map entries are just weird and not in keeping with an extremely highly educated human being. They, clerical errors that someone like him simply would not make. They had to indicate something was hidden within the narrative itself, or in that case, the legend on the map. We also had the Lewis and Clark expedition that explored that territory, and each the leaders, the both captains, William Clark and Meriwether Lewis, were tasked by President Thomas Jefferson to encode, encipher, if you will, anything that they perceived as a threat to the very young United States, and to send that message back through the river system to the president directly. And they did, apparently, or at least some of the things in the journals certainly appear to use what is called the Grand Cipher, developed by the French in the in the 16th century and went unbroken until the very late 19th century. And even at that, they only broke one page of the cipher because they figured out the key for that particular message. Each message could have its own key, which made it virtually unbreakable. Jefferson used it. He was taught it probably by Lafayette. Both he, Washington, and a number of other of the very early United States politicians and patriots, if you want to use that word, used it for secure communication. And Lewis and Clark used it during their journey, and you can see it in some of the journals, not just by them, but some of the other members of the Corps of Discovery used something like it. I don't have the key, so I can't tell you exactly what they were saying, but certainly they were using a cipher. Mm. It's just kind of interesting that they would do that for, you know, something that was supposedly just a voyage of discovery, you know?
Well, you know, there's many voyages of discovery that have been undertaken by mankind in the past, and most of which were secret because you don't want to let people know that you're trying to discover something important, because then other people will try and discover it as well and stake right. their claim on it.
Right, and that's very similar to what happened with the Spanish, Portuguese, and Columbus, because by many accounts, Columbus actually had a map that was provided by the Portuguese, who turned him down for his first voyage, incidentally. And he ended up going to Spain to get the money. So it's a long-standing tradition to keep the secrets, particularly with regard to important trade routes, which is what North America was. So that's what I'm recording and researching continually.
Yeah.
So does that help?
Yeah, it does. How long have you been doing it, and what got you into it? Because something tells me you could make a hell of a lot of money in your own personal life if you sold your soul and covered stuff that didn't matter.
Well, I've been interested in it since my teenage years. I was 14, maybe 15 years old, when I encountered a couple of the local self-styled historians who told me about a line of forts or fortresses across southern Indiana here in the United States. And at first I thought they were just full of it, you know. But then I started reading up on the history within the Indiana Historical Society, and they were telling me the truth. Two of those fortresses were actually known in the historical record, even though one of them was poo-pooed by the Smithsonian Institution. That was a deliberate attempt to cover up something that was very real and mattered. And the reason it mattered, because the local legend near Louisville, Kentucky, or on the Indiana side, it's Charlestown, Indiana, was that this fortress was built by the ancient Welsh who came here. One version says 1170 AD, and the other one says 570 AD. In either case, they would have been led by Celtic Christians, or Chaldees, as they're known there. And that would have meant that there were Christians in America before Columbus, which would, under the papal bull of 1452, the one that both the Spanish and the Portuguese used to claim lands in Americas, the claims would have been invalid because there were already Christians in America. Mm-hmm. So that's where I'm coming from on the whole conspiracy side and why all the governments, England, Spain, France, United States, perhaps even the Netherlands, knew this and chose to ignore it and cover up parts of it deliberately. So that's what my book's about. And my ongoing research is on some of the things that I touched on in the book about just how sophisticated these people were who governed and probably taxed, tithed, controlled the traffic on the rivers. So that's what I'm researching right now, is not only who they were, when they were doing it, but what technologies did they use to communicate?
Do you have a working thesis? What do you think happened before you've done your research?
They used line of sight communications with light, both day and night, and they had different technologies for whether it was period of darkness or period of daylight. In the daylight, they used reflectors to reflect sunlight, just like the United States Army did in the late 19th century, what they called a heliograph. It would bounce sunlight through a shuttered device and used Morse code just like a telegraph, but it was light. And they documented a path over 270 miles as their most successful that the United States Army could set up. And this was with portable equipment. If you had fixed installations, as the ancients did, you could conceivably send a message from the East Coast of America to the Mississippi River in an afternoon.
That's quite sophisticated there.
It is quite sophisticated.
And where did they come up with this with these methodologies and tech?
That's a really good question. The same thing was going on at the same time in Britain and throughout the Roman Empire with a slightly different technology, but they were doing it. They had polished metal mirrors in the old world, and in the new world they had a natural thing called mica, which essentially makes a very good mirror all by itself. In, I want to say it's Ipswich, but I'd have to look up the exact name of the town. They found an ancient Roman lantern, 1st century BC up to about 1st century AD in design. This one's actually been repaired. In ancient times, it had already been broken and repaired, but it used, the archaeologists tried to claim they used a shaved cow horn as a wind screen for a natural oil lantern. And the reality is the Romans were extremely good with glass, and it probably looked a whole lot like a Coleman lantern, but with a shutter on it. And the shutter would have made it a signal device throughout the British Isles, throughout Gaul, as they called it.
So it could be closed and opened rapidly, allowing it to be used for some sort of Morse code, perhaps?
Correct. And I'm certain that's what it did. By the design of the frame on it, it certainly had something that was used like a shutter. Now, when it was lost and crushed, it probably had already lost its shutter. Like I said, it had already been repaired once. So it was probably a toss off as far as the signaling device, but it would still been a good lantern, if you will. Good lighting device. In North America, you find literally thousands of high points along rivers and not near rivers. Some of them artificial, some of them natural, that show signs of vitrification of the soil, meaning they had a rather large and very hot fire at one time. That's not all they use for signals. But at night, they had to make light, and they probably did it with a fire. Well, I'm pretty certain they did it with a fire. Just how big and what type and how did they direct it and how did they pulse it, if you will? How did they make a code out of it?
They weren't just using it for partying, you know, running around the big fire naked and drumming and so on and forth.
Well, yeah, they did that too, but not at
those. So it's a dual-purpose signal fire.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Look at this, boys. We could use this to communicate and get wasted.
Yeah, pretty much. They had plenty of materials for that, too. They made pipes. It wasn't all for tobacco. They had probably at least 43 different natural plants that were mind-altering in one way or another, some hallucinogenic, some simply psychotropic. And then they had various combinations. Everybody had their own blend. And some of the pipes that have been recovered in an archaeological context, meaning, you know, the farmer who found it didn't use it, but the archaeologist who found it sent it to a laboratory, and they've been able to isolate some of the compounds in it. It's pretty interesting what those folks could do.
Well, it sounds like they're not entirely dissimilar from the rest of humanity today. You know, you go over, you explore new things and make discoveries, and then you get high to celebrate.
Well, yeah, that's part of it. They also had, and here I'm talking Native Americans, they also had at least two or three different forms of alcoholic drink. They had a corn beer, which was probably awful by our standards, but hey, you know, drink what you got. I mean, you guys get Foster's too, right?
Unfortunately.
Yeah, exactly. I've had Norwegian Christmas beer too.
Christmas beer?
Yeah, it's a
what is that, tradition. Like eggnog and vodka?
No, it's a home-brewed beer. Once in a great while, somebody does a good job. Most of the time, they do not.
Okay.
But they don't brew, home-brew real good beer in Norway.
And I'm or at not least a fan the people you yet. Know.
That, correct.
You need some new friends, yo. You need some new friends.
I have visited there 9 times, and I still have not found all the things or visited all the places that I would like to in Norway, because there is a lot of history there with regard to North America and my research.
Well, how so?
Leif Erikson, son of Erik the Red, founder of the colonies in Greenland, was run out of Norway for murder. He was banished. He was run out of Iceland for murder, and he was banished, and he formed a colony in Greenland. Well, part of that banishment included his sons, plural, but Leif in particular, became a ward of the King of Norway. And later on, Leif was tasked by the king to go to Greenland and find out just why the hell they weren't paying their taxes and tribute and tithes and stuff. And to make sure that they were indeed Christians, which Erik wasn't. But while he was in Greenland, he heard about this land to the west, Vinland. Well, he didn't know it was Vinland then. He called it Vinland when he got back, but he visited North America. And a colony was established in Vinland. Well, hold on. There's that Christians in North America before Columbus thing again. So the practicality is probably never get anything changed, but the bare bones legal thing is all the claims were illegal.
Well, this is this is something that's pretty widely accepted among people, that there were kind of like sort of Viking people and what have you coming into America pre-Columbus. Isn't that just kind of mainstream now? There's even been a movie about it starring the New Zealander Carl Urban called Pathfinder about
this. That was a great movie, I thought. It was a little far-fetched because the Vikings didn't have ships with holds in them. They had longboats. That was the main, in my opinion, main faux pas of that motion picture. But the idea that Norse and or Vikings, which Vikings were just Norse who were down on their luck and wanted to, you know, use somebody else's money for a while or go party real hardy in Britain usually.
So they were kind of the socialists of their day.
In a way they were. You know, you've got it and I want it. So here, meet my sword.
Yeah. And the problem is eventually you run out of everybody else's money to waste.
Exactly. That's what Ronald Reagan said too. But
Reagan and the Vikings, they were like this.
Yes. It's like dinosaur hugs. But the Vikings, if you will, probably were not, almost certainly were not Leif Erikson or any of the party in any of the members in that party that founded Vinland, founded and lived in Vinland for some period of time, which meets a criteria of a colony, which kind of negates the whole papal bull thing.
What happened to them? Did they die out? Did they intermarry with local Indian tribes? And then the stories weren't passed down of proper historical records. What happened to the colony?
The colony was abandoned when they got into it with some of the locals. Not all of them. I don't think that Vinland was the only colony. It's the only one that actually got a written record called the Vinland Saga. It was written in, I want to say, 1106, so it was, you know, some time afterwards, by Snorri Snorrason of Iceland, who wrote it down for the first time. Therefore, the historians say, well, that's not valid because it was passed down word of mouth. Well, really? For 100 years?
Do you think all ancient cultures recorded their historical events other than word of mouth, you know?
That's exactly right. But that doesn't matter much to historians because it's not a written record from the get-go.
Well, their asinine argument doesn't hold any weight, I think.
I concur with that. You know, Napoleon Bonaparte said history is but a fiction agreed upon. And
sounds
he
about right.
Would be in a position to know, which, by the way, is a quote at the very front of my book.
Well, there you go. Now, moving on from that, I mean, it would be interesting to find out, like, the discrepancies between written records and what we call word-of-mouth records and what have you, because there's not only stories of ancient America and what have you, we've even found footprints in stone, human footprints next to dinosaur footprints, and they were laid about the same time. There was some creek bed in the States somewhere.
Glen Rose, Texas.
Yeah, yes. That's the one.
And Dr. Hugh Miller has, and his son, went on after that discovery. They went on to excavate further up that creek bed, separate that layer of rock further up with witnesses and photography and videography and, you know, whole thing, and they found more. So it's not like it's completely unrepeatable.
I've been coming to a conclusion just of recent times, Rick, and maybe you'll vibe with this as well, is when you're trying to explain anything to quote-unquote reductionist thinkers, mm-hmm. It comes to the point where they don't believe evidence is evidence. You find soil samples, rock samples, historical records, written stuff, passed down stories and everything like that, and it doesn't fit with their narrative, so they go, nah, it doesn't count as evidence, nah.
Right. And that's kind of the unscience part of the scientific method. Whereas, as an example, you take carbon-14 or radiocarbon testing. of samples of organic materials. And let's say you get a dozen of them and five of them fit your paradigm. You throw out the rest because they don't fit the paradigm. We only keep the five bits of evidence that support your theory or your hypothesis. Wait a minute. I thought the data was supposed to drive the theory rather than vice versa. So when, as Dr. U. Miller did, when you retrieve some radiocarbon containing biological material from a dinosaur bone that couldn't possibly have a radiocarbon signature if it was more than 40, 50,000 years old, there's something wrong with the paradigm.
Well, there's more things that are wrong with the paradigm than are right with it, isn't it? Something occurred to me as well is that this isn't an accident, you know, that people think this way, or rather can't think in that particular vein, is because certain people taught them what to think, how to reason, etc. And I believe that the education system has been structured in such a way to prevent free thinking and to prevent a reliance on factual evidence, and instead rely mostly on authority figures for their information, because authorities obviously are never wrong or lie or abuse their power. And that's basically the end of the story. You got taught by a bunch of people who have an interest in making sure that you can't think, and so that when somebody who does and can think comes along and tells you something you're not prepared for, you think, ironically, that they're the one who's stupid and can't think. And not you.
Yeah. I recently read a piece, a debunking piece, if you will, by an archaeologist who said, oh, all these diffusionists, they're just a bunch of groupthink. They get an idea and everybody wants to share that idea. It's like, really? Because that's exactly what I think about archaeologists. If it's not the same as you think, it's wrong. So, and
is this part of like an obsession to be correct? You know, I don't like being correct. That, I like being corrected more.
Yeah, I like learning. And if I'm only dictating, then I'm not learning. The other thing that I find very interesting about archaeologists is once they retire, they'll say, oh, no, it's not a science. We just like to say it is. That's also in my book. I got a whole chapter about that.
There's actually quite a few fields of science that aren't science. Psychiatry, for instance.
As an example, yeah. One of the greatest physicists, particle physicists, any kind of physics, actually, Richard Feynman, he just had a ball any time that there was a psychology minor in his physics class, because he'd say, really? You call that an experiment? And then he'd proceed to tear him apart.
Yeah. Well, I think this is a good point to leave the first segment. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be right back after the break with Rick Osman. Back in a minute. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humour, you will go friggin' nuts. And my very special guest, who is a specialist in some of the madness, namely, he goes up against it, people who are incapable of reasoning, like historians, ironically. Rick Osman, welcome back.
Thank you. Yeah, it is one of my favorite pastimes. And there's no end to, you know, new versions of the insanity and whatnot. There was a very famous, very adept diffusionist whose, you know, day job was she was a lawyer and a judge. In particular, she tried cases of intellectual property, patent, copyright, etc. Her name was Henrietta Mertz, and she used the Latin phrase ipsi dixit to describe some of this "because I said so" stuff. And it was an infamous phrase for many years. People had just about forgotten Henrietta now, and that's too bad all by itself, because she was an amazing person, did amazing work. She was challenged by another judge to do a mock trial of diffusion versus Columbus discovery first. Well, Columbus lost his case in a big way. And if that were done today, it would almost certainly have the same result. And it does have that result, particularly within the popular press, so to speak, your show included. The believers here outnumber the non-believers as far as diffusion. Probably.
Could you define diffusion just for the uneducated? This would include me as well.
Okay, diffusion, cultural diffusion in particular, there's a number of versions of it. Cultural diffusion would be, for instance, we're using the same tools. I'm guessing you're using a PC with probably Microsoft Windows.
Mac.
Similar technology, different rich guy.
Pretty much.
But the running all the same programs, they just run a little differently. And that's another parallel between the North American version of the line of sight communications and the old world version, which the Romans did not invent. Incidentally, they took it from somebody they conquered, probably Carthage.
May I offer an interjection?
Sure.
Because the invention of the telescope, I think, was 9 different people at different sides of the earth on the same night came up with the same invention.
Well, that's one version of the interpretation. Let's go back a little further to the Maya in the Yucatan. There's actually a stele, a phrase, of a Mayan looking through a telescope at the stars. And that culture pretty much died out by 1000 AD. And supposedly they barely had metal working technology, let alone optics working technology.
Well, I think there's two elements here, and I totally agree with what you're talking about, because not only is there suppressed, ancient, / forgotten about technology, but there's also ancient, suppressed, forgotten about abilities of human beings.
Certainly. The intellectual level of the ancients probably outstrips us by several orders of magnitude. Hmm. I mentioned Jefferson as an example with the cryptography. He held a different key for each correspondent, and he held that key in his head and never screwed up any of the communication. How difficult would that be? He probably had some system that worked well for him, and he just kept it, but he never conveyed it to anyone except each individual correspondent had their own key, which they probably had to write down and keep secret. Whereas he could keep it in his head.
Well, what kind of keys are these? Are these harmonics or?
No, actually, with the grand cipher, typically, and this is at the very general level of it, a single syllable has a set of digits, a numerical number, if you will, that represents a syllable. Now, in French, you know, they have a certain number of syllables. In English, we have a certain number of syllables that we use all the time. But if you use the same key with each of the syllables all the time, then you would not have a secure code. Somehow or another, Jefferson and Lafayette and Washington and Adams and a bunch of the others were able to keep keys for individual correspondence. That made it a lot easier to track the spies because it would only go one way to one person. And if you sent the same message to a different person, it would come up different. That's where it gets really interesting on Jefferson.
Could you elaborate further on that? Do you know any more pieces to the puzzle there?
I can elaborate to the extent that during the Corps of Discovery venture west, that Lewis and Clark were teaching other members of the Corps of Discovery to use this code, and it shows up in the journals of those other members. For instance, in one account, I believe it was September the 10th, 1804. I could be wrong on the date, but you had three different journal entries about they discovered the skeleton of a giant fish on the banks of the river, 45 feet long. And each entry was very similar or almost exact, except for one, Mr. Gass, who elaborated and were taking a sample of the bones to send back to Washington City. There's another example of not everybody got the same message. Now, with the grand cipher in the French realm, for instance, the artillery general would get one message using a key that was for him. And the artillery general would get one for him, and the cavalry would get one for him, and the admiral would get a different one. So that whoever was running a war could send an individual message to each of the others and guarantee that if there was a spy, not all would get the same message exactly.
That reminds me of a chapter in Sun Tzu's The Art of War. When communicating to your own troops, it's best to put incorrect information into your own troops' hands. That way you'll be able to find out who the traitors are and also have nobody know what the real plan is until the commander gives the order at the opportune time.
Correct. Sun Tzu knew that 5,000 years ago, or I'm sorry, 3,100 years ago.
So we're talking about a technological advent that's based upon an ancient military practice.
And psychology that goes back 3 millennia.
Wow. So we're talking about something from the dawn of man, or was there some point throughout human history where suddenly, boom, everything changed and we got all this technology like the ancient alien theory suggests?
I'm not a believer in the ancient alien theory. I am a believer that man has always been intellectually adept. For instance, could you go get in a boat, I don't care what size it is, and navigate your way to the United States or any place else across an ocean without a GPS, without a sextant, without a Lorentz sea or any of the modern navigational aids?
Nah, you'd be screwed.
No, not if you knew how they did it. And they told us how they did it.
Well, just they navigated watched. By the stars.
Yes, they navigated by the stars completely. And you still can because, well, okay, they've changed a little bit. They changed completely in 12,000 years, give or take. And they come back full circle in about 26.4, actually. So it's not an unknown thing. The technology has always been there, and people were navigating and sailing at least 40,000 years ago to get to Australia, and probably 30,000 years ago to get to New Zealand, although Moray tend to disagree with that.
And of course, this is just based upon the artifacts that we can currently unearth. There may be artifacts even deeper and older. We could conceivably be going back millions of years, right?
Well, certainly the oldest tools that have been found outside of Africa, to my knowledge, are about 120,000 years old. And they were on Crete. And they didn't walk there either. They had to sail. So somebody was sailing the Med 120,000 years ago. somebody, if, you know, conceivably you could have walked to North America at one time, but you could not walk to Crete. You couldn't walk to Australia or New Zealand. Even when the height of the ice age had the sea level 300 to 600 feet lower in some places, it was still deep ocean between those two bodies of land and the main body of land.
I believe also people have been claiming that there was some form of supercontinent in the Pacific, and New Zealand's like at the tip of it, and the rest of it stretches all the way north to like Hawaii and then across to Easter Island or something of that nature, like that little kind of big triangle allegedly used to be some form of enormous landmass. And divers, I think, off the coast of Japan and quite a number of countries have.
Yeah, Yonaguni in particular, which is the southernmost tip of the Japanese archipelago and is almost within sight of Shanghai. I'm sorry, not Shanghai, Taipei. It's almost within sight of Formosa, if you want to call it that, the island off the People's Republic of China, which is, you know, free China, so to speak. Anyway, they that particular monumental megalithic work is 90 feet underwater. But 15,000 years ago, it could have been as much as 200 feet above sea level, maybe more. It was essentially a hilltop, and it was worked by hand, probably with metal to almost certainly with metal tools and a great deal of engineering acuity.
Yeah.
So yeah, there was somebody working stuff here on this planet a long time ago, and I'm convinced they were human. Maybe not Homo sapiens sapien like us, but they were human and they were smart. Cro-Magnon as an example. Cro-Magnon is a forerunner, an early version of us. But he was, you know, as much as 7.5-8 feet tall, and his brain case to body mass was bigger even than that by about 10%. He was potentially super intelligent. And he probably started things like, oh, I don't know, the copper culture and sailed and traded and made pottery and farmed and animal husbandry and all those things that people say
quite a lot of evidence of that. I believe a goat skin map of South America, the east side of South America, the southeast of the United States, and just the very, very west of Africa. So somebody had a map on goat skin that was drawn pretty much accurate to the measurement to our modern maps today, and they had Africa, North America, and South America on that map with trade routes plotted out on it.
And Antarctica.
Oh, yeah. Now I remember, yeah.
Perry Reese, who supposedly drew that map in, I believe it was 1507, and he was a Turkish admiral. But he should not have been privy to South America, North America, or Antarctica. Africa was pretty well known 5,000 years ago. Its general shape, its dimensions, etc. The ancient Egyptians paid the Phoenicians, Mano specifically, to circumnavigate Africa. And he did. It took him 3.5 years. But it's in the Egyptian histories. So people have been sailing with some acumen for a very long time. Now back to the navigation stuff. What tools did they use? Well, I think that is in the old art, and it'll be in my next book. So stay tuned.
There's lots more to come. And the best part about having your profession based upon hundreds of thousands of years, etc., of human history and whatnot, is that you never run out of material for new books because there's hundreds of thousands of years worth of it.
Correct. Also, I'm writing for Ancient American Magazine, and started with a number of the fortresses I investigated in my book, but also the line of sight communications network. And they kind of go hand in hand because one supported the other and vice versa. So of the 45 stone fortresses that I've identified, well, and a lot of the antiquarians of the 19th century identified them before me. Nevertheless, they are out there and I can write for that magazine for years and never get off topic.
There is that much information out there, and it's funny, we should get onto just how much there is, because I was thinking just about a minute ago as you were speaking, some people might be wondering at this point, well, what's the point? We've got ancient people, blah, 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 blah. What does that really change? Does it make any difference knowing these things today?
Particularly with regard to the navigation? Yes, because as soon as there is the next coronal mass ejection from the sun, the next time the sun decides to burp in our direction, the GPS, all the electronic devices go dead. They are never to be resurrected in our lifetime again, probably. So the old methods will be the only methods we can use.
Well, in this case, you're talking about kind of like a ancient survivalist school kind of thing.
Well, in essence, yeah. The old methods will still work because it's not going to destroy the Earth or change its rotation rate or its position in the solar system. So our navigation, if we want to cross oceans, and oh, by the way, if you still want to drink coffee, you'll have to get it from someplace else. Because I don't believe they have coffee beans in New Zealand, do they?
Yeah, we do, actually. We've got a coffee plantation on Waiheke Island that's just off the coast of Auckland, a 35-minute ferry ride.
Then that'll be the next generation's Bill Gates.
Oh, yeah.
Because nobody can do without their coffee once they're
nobody.
Hooked on, like, an IR.
Nobody. I mean, dude, I was driving down the road with my wife just the other day, and we were talking about how easy some substances and drugs are easy to, like, give up or not do. You know, like, it's not that difficult to just decide I'm not going to have a cigarette today. It's not that difficult to say, no, I'm not going to buy that bottle of liquor. It's not that difficult to refuse a puff on a joint. But to not have your coffee in the morning, there are immediate consequences. Headaches.
For society, not just for the individual.
A friend of mine who I knew when I was quite young, around 19, he ran a company, and he was drinking at least 6 espressos a day and then gave up cold turkey. He fired 2 employees that day.
Yeah.
Now, does that strike you as something that's actually a little bit scary? I mean, what happens when the coffee runs out, bro? Are we going to have, like, really, really angry people everywhere?
Well, for a short time we will, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, how long do the effects last? Because I tried to give up coffee for an entire week and the symptoms didn't leave me.
If you can survive 6 weeks or so, you'll be over it.
6 weeks of aggro. Sweet mercy.
Yeah. Yeah, something like that.
Oh, my God.
And I hope I never have to find out. I hope nobody around me ever has to find out.
You know, I mean, that's it. I'm going down to one of those illegal grow stores and I'm getting myself a coffee hydroponics kit, you know. You'd be like secretly growing coffee in your spare room and stuff like that, hoping nobody finds out about it.
Probably a law against it, but...
Yeah. no, but then again, how... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Well, it's an analogy, if you will. The United States was formed because of a very similar dependence upon tea. And the taxation upon that tea. And we told King George, hey, screw you. We're going to get our tea elsewhere.
And it wasn't just King George. It was the Dutch East India Trading Company.
Which
incidentally, I believe it went under a corporate merger or something and then just started to... It started all these other companies like the Queen and Wright of New Zealand, for example. Which is
one example.
Yeah. And I think there's company names for England, and all the countries basically became corporations, more or less. And I think
this they already were.
Yeah.
They already were in reality. They just took a different legal form. The Virginia Company was founded to exploit tobacco and sell it in the old world, tobacco being a new world plant. And it made it, guns and a few other commodities like whiskey, made the United States rich in its infancy. Now we're paying the price for a little bit of overindulgence, not in those products, but in the money that came from them. We also had copper. During the 19th century, we mined someplace around 50 million pounds of copper from Lake Superior region.
It was the cheapest metal at the time in the United States.
And it was overabundant. It was overabundant, and it was very near the top of the ground, and it was very nearly pure. And it wasn't the first round of mining it either. People have mined it for 9,000 years. You know, before there was a copper culture, according to the historians and archaeologists, people were mining copper in the Lake Superior region.
Incidentally, the world's first professional police force, the NYPD, had a very low budget when they first started up, and the cheapest available metal that they could get and cut into badges was roofing copper. And so everybody started calling them coppers, which later got shortened to cops.
Bingo. You got it.
Now, when we talk about the United States in and of itself, your speciality is it seems to me quite varied. You can talk about ancient America, Middle America, Revolutionary America, and the origins and the of the species, more or less. Would that be about right?
Yeah, that's a pretty good rundown.
Could I ask you what's your favorite period then when talking about American history, whether it be ancient all the way up to modern?
My very favorite period of history would be the early Americas, early United States, I should say, up to about 1820, 1830, someplace in there. Because even though we had historians and newspapers and all that stuff, there's still a lot of stuff that's hidden. And 1820, 1818 specifically, is when Indiana, as a state, acquired the rest of Indiana from the Native Americans. And up until that time, it was white settlers versus natives, or natives versus white settlers. And it was a back and forth. It was a shooting war for basically 200 years before that. When the French were here, it was more of a trade war thing. And all the English settlers were on the East Coast. Indiana was settled by 1735. When I say settled, it was one town settled by whites. And then the natives built a town around it to trade with the French. It's named for Marquis de Vincennes, who was actually burned at the stake by a different set of Indians. And he didn't found the town of Vincennes, but it was named for him in his honor and his memoriam as a dead guy. And he traded in Buffalo Heights.
Oh, is that right? Well, a slaughterer of buffalo gets burned at the stake. You know,
for invading a different country, in essence. He went into Arkansas and the Osage killed him, burned him at the stake.
I love that line from The Matrix. Fate, it seems, is not without a sense of irony.
It now, certainly had that.
Rick Osmond is my very special guest, ladies and gentlemen. This episode is sponsored by the High Tea Cafe in New Lynn. Also, the Gourmet Soup Kitchen in Wagga Wagga. Wagga Wagga. If you go down and like click the little banner there and you go to that website, oh my god, they got some nice looking soap, bro. Honestly, it's like jewelry for your filthy body. Go get some of that stuff. We'll be right back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Hope you enjoyed that little break there. And my very special guest is still Rick Osman. We're talking about his favourite little period of history around the early 1820s, isn't it? This is your favourite period of American history. From ancient to today, this is it. I don't know.
Yes.
I don't know about that for my personal flavour, because I don't know much about that period of history, and I'd appreciate it if you'd continue to regale me.
Sure. In particular, because I grew up here in Indiana, I'm very familiar with the history, the early history of its settlement. And even before the white settlers were here, the white traders were here, and as well as the missionaries and a lot of other folks. But the interaction of whites in this region with the natives goes back to at least about 1520, because in some of the Native American villages or places where there were Native American villages, you occasionally find artifacts of Spanish conquistadors or French missionaries or French traders and the stuff that they left behind, either as trade goods or lost in battle because that conquistador didn't make it. Mm. We have also the Native American lore, the spoken history, is much more manifest and much more, encompassing than most of the doctrinal historians would have you believe. Certain tribes have a history, a tribal history of how their tribe, in this case the Ojibwa, controlled the rivers. They were like the NYPD, if you will, of the rivers system of North America, meaning
meaning they were controlled by gangs and organized crime.
Well, they certainly had their bouts with other entities for control of the river or river systems. And the reason they wanted to control it was so that they could collect basically a toll or a fee for trading up and down the rivers. Well, the same thing at the same time was happening in the old world with the Romans. Okay, they dressed differently. They spoke a different language. They wrote differently. And yes, the Native Americans did have writing. They just don't want us to know that. Because they also had records. They just didn't use books exactly.
You ever heard the phrase, great minds think alike?
Yeah.
Yeah. Scumbaggery minds think alike too.
Yes, they do, certainly. And when they have a secret to keep, they do it very, very well. When the Romans would invade someplace, let's take Carthage as an example. Yeah, they sowed salt in all the Carthage so that it wouldn't grow wheat. Well, they didn't grow wheat in Carthage itself anyway. They grew it around Carthage. What they actually did in Carthage was they stole all the libraries and they culled the books for anything that could be of use to Rome. When they finally sacked Sicily, there was a standing order to capture Archimedes alive because they wanted that brain. That was the very first example of Operation Paperclip, if you know that one. But they wanted to capture the enemy brains and use them. The Romans, when they conquered some place, the first thing they wanted was the history so they could find out where those places were trading and what they were trading for and how they did it and how they got there, etc. And one example of that that we know happened is Carthage had a copper mine, a little bit of silver, a little bit of gold also, in Spain, a place that today is called Rio Tinto. And a mining company is named Rio Tinto because of that mine that was there that the Romans reopened in the first century BC and mined for about 200 years. And then they just kind of let it go to waste. And then in the 19th century, a London company reading Roman history found out, hey, they had a mine. We should go check it out. And they formed a mining company and they mined it for another 100 years. And now Rio Tinto is one of the largest copper mining outfits in the world. So the use of history to discern trade routes, trade goods, good, bad, or indifferent is something that Rome used effectively. The very early United States did that as well. As an example, back to the copper, when Benjamin Franklin was negotiating the treaty with the English at the end of the Revolution, our Revolution, the War for Independence, depending on where you are, what you call it, he negotiated for a place called Isle Royal. It's an island out in the middle of Lake Superior, and they had to make a big jog out around it to draw the new boundary line. But he said, I'm not leaving here without that island. And that was the copper that was mined during the 19th century, all, you know, 5, 10, 50 million pounds of it, whatever it actually was. Somebody put a bug in his ear that, hey, you want that island. And it about had to have been the French allies because they were the only ones who had spent a lot of time around there. So the history was there from someplace. How the French got it, I don't know.
Well, how does a Frenchman normally discern secrets from his enemy? He sleeps with his wife.
Yeah, seduction. That's right.
You'd be surprised how sexy a Frenchman is if you've had enough French wine.
Yeah, that kind of goes back to the very first Indiana Jones movie. But, oh, wait, he grew up on that stuff.
Yeah, it's true. Now, speaking of which, the French have an interesting relationship here for New Zealanders as well, because when our indigenous people, the Maori, were signing a treaty with the British, it occurred to a lot of historians, honest ones at least, that the Maori were actually quite hurriedly trying to get a treaty with the British, principally because they wanted British protection from the French.
Yeah. Well, and they also already had their history of dealings with the Portuguese, or somebody who certainly resembled the Portuguese in the very early 16th century. Spaniards. And the Portuguese had been, but the Portuguese had already been trading with Japan for 100 years before that, according to the Japanese.
There's also a story. I'm sorry. I'm still interrupting you, Rick. Please continue.
Okay. Well, going back to the Japanese and their trade organization or trade relations with Western Europe, there were some 4th century Roman glass beads found in a 4th century Japanese tomb. That means it was pretty, you know, rapid transit. They had a regular trade route throughout Eurasia. You find Roman coins throughout India and Sri Lanka and even into Vietnam. The historians say, oh, no, they didn't do that. They couldn't possibly have traded that far. Really? Because when Cleopatra was, well, when she killed herself rather than be captured, she was about to board a ship to go to India and escape. They had regular trade routes from Egypt too. But in that case, she would have had to have either gone out the Red Sea or circumnavigated Africa. So they had some pretty sophisticated sailing and navigation. I guess that's where I'm going with that.
Yeah. I mean, they didn't have no Suez Canal, so you could just take a shortcut, you know.
Well, and they didn't have 747s per se.
Oh, in fact, that reminds me of a joke. There's a Maori comedian called Pio, and he was in a car with an islander guy, you know, from Tonga. And the guy from Tonga says, you Maori are freaking stupid, eh? You know, you sail here in these little rickety ships from all the way across the seas and risk your life and limb. We just wait for the Palangis to build a 747.
Yeah. Yeah, or the Chinese. Because they're building their own now.
Hey, the Chinese are building their own everything now. Have you noticed?
Yeah, they're building a lot of our stuff too.
Yeah,
I own about a half a dozen Chinese built guitars.
Hey, when was the last time you walked into a store and you thought that and you really could be convinced that nothing there was from China?
Wow, that's been a while.
It's been about 30 years or something, hasn't it?
Unless you go to the local artisan only shops, and we do have a couple of those. They don't have anything practical. It's all art, decorations, etc.
Stuff that you don't need. In fact,
stuff you don't need. That's right.
Haven't you noticed that's kind of like a coming trend with all of our Western societies? None of us are producing stuff that we actually need. We're all service industry oriented, which means we need other people and their money and their resources and their processing and their labor to survive. We have no independence of any kind.
Well, we have limited independence here because where I am in southern Indiana, we still have a lot of farm ground. And I live at the edge of an Amish community. So they're fairly well, you know, I won't say totally independent, but they're fairly self-sufficient. And therefore, a lot of the goods that support self-sufficiency are readily available here. Things to cook and heat a home and, you know, transport without oil or electricity are here. So I'm well availed of things for self-sufficiency.
And oddly enough. And that's just you. You'd be in a very unique position by comparison to, say, the average resident of Los Angeles County or New York City.
They're all screwed. 3 days and all the grocery stores are empty. Seriously. Both those cities.
And the way people panic by the way people panic by it won't be 3 days, mate. It'll be 3 hours.
Oh yeah, agreed. You know, one snowstorm and not necessarily in either one of those cities, but one snowstorm in a major city and the shelves are empty. But at one point in time, they're going to be empty, never to be refilled.
Or they'll be refilled and they'll be so expensive that you can't buy it.
Yeah, well. Either way, they're screwed. All those people are done.
Well, this doesn't fly in the face with Agenda 21, does it? see, I was just thinking about this as well, because on the one hand, we have the quote-unquote collapse of society thing looming in on us because of struggling resources, climate collapse, Fukushima, name your end-of-the-world disaster. It's already going on, you know. A lot of people say it's inevitable. There's limits to human creativity. There's no outwitting a bell curve of population explosion and then decline. There's no possible way out of that. And then on the other hand, what I see is Agenda 21 being implemented all over the place to ensure that that collapse happens and collapses in a controlled fashion. So that it won't be all of these crises and everything that kill you. It'll be the people that are telling you about these crises and giving you the solutions to the problems that'll kill you. Yeah.
Never let a good crisis go to waste.
Isn't that a profound realization? That no matter how bad things get, the people who are talking about how bad things are actually probably the thing most likely to kill you.
Yes. And the least likely to kill us in mass is the one that we can't possibly escape and they can't possibly control. And that's a big asteroid.
Yeah.
But back to that coronal mass ejection, if that happens, society will collapse. Many millions, tens, hundreds of millions, possibly billions of people will starve to death for lack of electronic communication. Hey, we need a truckload of anything to eat. And oh, why? What do you mean the truck won't run? It's diesel. Well, yeah, but it's got electronic injectors on it. So even a diesel's not going to run.
Yeah, nothing's going to work, eh? You'd be basically back to steam engines and, even telegraph won't work. Steam engines
well, not
and horseback.
You string some new lines.
Pardon?
Not until you string some new lines for the telegraph. Yeah. The only vehicles that will survive intact at the moment that that coronal mass ejection hits are the submarines who are submerged more than, you know, 3 to 30 feet, depending on where they are in the world and which side it actually hits. They will survive. Their electronics will be intact. The only problem is the only people they'll be able to talk to is each other. And they don't want to do that because, oh, wait, they're the only surviving nuke force.
But what about the satellites? Wouldn't they all be knocked out by it? So that would the submarines wouldn't even be able to communicate with each other. Maybe what shortwave? I don't know how
long. Actually, very, very low frequency. ELF, extremely low frequency, is how they would communicate. They can communicate with each other. They can communicate with various naval centers that have that particular setup, except that those centers will no longer exist because all their antennas are going to be fried. But the subs could talk to each other in a limited fashion.
What about...
It's a very slow communication.
There would be sub-communication. You said between 30 feet. What about the deep underground military bases that have been exposed and talked about all over the planet, underwater ones as well? They'd all be running high as life.
They would survive that event. Well, their electronics would survive that event. Okay. The people probably would not be affected directly by the event. Only their lifestyle would change. Everybody here on the surface is going to be pretty much screwed as far as communications, transportation, cooking appliances, refrigeration. All that's going to be gone. There will be no power unless you can make it with your own wind turbine and manufacture your own generator, because those are going to fry too. So any of the long lines are going to be screwed.
There will be one group of people, ordinary people, topside, that have no technology. And there will be a second group of people, powerful people, who have technology. What do you think that is going to happen to the rest of society? It's just going to become a technocratic elite coming up out of the ground. Boom, we rule you. We've got all the weapons. We've got all the tech. Technocratic society. Well, at least that's what I'd do if I was a totally crazy criminal psychopathic scumbag.
Well, there's another side to that coin, though. All of us up here, we may not have communications, but we control all the food.
However, storable food within the United States from all of the major suppliers is currently on between a 3 to 18 month wait list, because the government and major corporations have come in and bought out pretty much all the freeze dried food. So yeah. These people will have stockpiles of food, munitions, fuels, advanced technology, communications, and we'll have none of that, more or less.
We'll have food. We won't have the long-term storage food. We'll be going from season to season, just like the ancients did. Oh, wait, even they would store food. They had dried fish, dried meat. They had pemmican. They had beans and rice and you name it. They had a lot of stored foods, stored as dry grain. It'll keep you alive until you can do better.
Oh, yeah, totally. And I think if in the case of a coronal mass ejection, one country has dealt with an energy shock before, where suddenly no energy was coming in, they're all oil embargoed and everything like that. What did they do? Cuba. They said to the people, grow food everywhere. Every patch of grass that is not being used to grow food, every bit of arable land in the entire country, if it ain't being used to grow food, occupy it, start growing it. Nobody starved to death, and they are currently one of the healthiest populations on Earth with the least amount of health problems.
Yeah. Well, yes and no. They have a lot of mental health problems, but as far as physical health, they're pretty good.
Yeah. It's surprising how the body can't live without the mind. And if you're under a communist dictatorship, you don't have the opportunity to exercise your mind all that much, especially if you're incapable of exercising free speech.
Especially then. And thank you for the opportunity for me to do that here.
Hey, it's got to be done, mate. I've been doing it for years and years and years. I figured as a young man that my elders possess far more knowledge than I, and that the general public, of which I include myself, possesses far less. So I've endeavoured to interview as many of my learned and wise and well-informed elders as possible for the benefit of not only them having the ability to tell their story in a comfortable and safe environment, but so the listeners can actually learn something really deeply, you know, not just 30-second soundbite BS, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
This deserves more coverage than it gets, and I'm on a one-man mission to change that reality.
Well, staying on the theme of food and replenishable food, Native American, well, throughout North America, at least, they had what they called the Three Sisters, beans, corn, and squash. Between those three, you get just about everything you need. You have to eat a pancreas of some animal now and then to get a little vitamin C. The Inuit, the Eskimos, et cetera, they'll eat a seal pancreas. They'll divide it up evenly amongst all the members of their family or tribe or their community. But that's how they survive without getting the rickets or scurvy or any of those other dastardly vitamin C deficiency diseases. When the English were sailing the world and, let's see, well, how would you say that? Subjugating much of the world, they put limes on the ships, and everybody got a pint of rum and a lime every day on the ship. And it kept them somewhat healthy and, well, satiated at least. But if the ancients, long before 10,000 years before the English were sailing the oceans, they had to have some plant that provided vitamin C for the sailors. In Egypt, they have the lily, the water lily. And in America, the Americas, they have the water lily. And they're both very, very high in vitamin C. Even though they're actually two different plants that look alike, they're still both high in vitamin C. And they would have provided enough of that commodity to keep a sailing crew healthy during a voyage across the ocean.
Didn't American sailors also have cranberries?
Yes. Once we were settled, they had cranberries. But until then, cranberries weren't known in the old world. Neither was pineapple, coffee, tomatoes, tobacco, maize or corn, most of the squash, a lot of the gourds, etc., are New World plants that have permeated the entire populated planet. And people don't think about that very often. But there were some 400 species of plants, animals, parasites, you name it, that were transported into populations long before Columbus ever sailed. So that tells me that somebody was sailing.
Yeah, and it wasn't Rod Stewart.
No. No, it was not. It wasn't Admiral Halsey either. But
yeah. Although it may have been Hogan's Heroes.
It could have been, yeah.
We can't confirm nor deny that one.
I know nothing.
I know nothing. You know, and it's amazing. He was actually quite being literal on occasion. Ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to The Vinnie Eastwood Show. This episode is sponsored by the High Tea Cafe and the Gourmet Soap Kitchen, as well as Blue Shield. You can go to the website and you scroll down. You can see the Blue Shield banner and you can click on that and order your plug-in and portable devices as well. We will see you after the break, ladies and gentlemen. Don't you go anywhere. And remember, sorry, before we go, to go to thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. That's Vinnie with a Y, because it's the most important question. And Eastwood, as in go ahead, make my news. And start making a regular donation today, preferably into that bank account there. For the Kiwi listeners internationally, I think it might be a little bit difficult, so that's why there's also a PayPal option there as well. So you give us a monthly gift of anywhere from $1 to $100 a month, depending on your resources. Please don't donate if you can't feed your family or house yourself. Don't do that, because then I feel guilty for you putting yourself out for me. It's supposed to be the other way around, mate. Okay? Go to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com and donate today. And we'll see you after the break. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand. The fabulous, the fluoridated, the Fukushima irradiated, where everybody has a job as an incandescent light bulb. And my very special guest, Rick Osmond. That's not Jamaican, is it? In Jamaica, everybody just calls you Oz. Mine.
Yeah, pretty much. And everybody in the United States as well. I'm called a lot of things, and I answer to most of them. But don't call me late for supper, and you never knew my mother, so let's leave her out of it.
This is true.
Yeah.
Now, we were talking about, over the break, bureaucratic mindsets. Now, I've talked to a lot of free-thinking people, and I've talked to a lot of bureaucratically unthinking people. And it's, ironically enough, quite the battle, because one's too stupid to admit that they don't know what they're talking about, and the other's honest enough to admit that they don't know everything, and so the other person think that gives them one over on them because they're just that freaking stupid.
Yeah, it has to do a lot with the number of letters after a name and what those letters are, as to the perception of the person who has those letters of the other person. Sorry, it does not define intellect. It does not define logic, nor does it define street sense, which is where most of them are totally lacking.
I want to have the fiduciary undergraduate qualification, so after my name, I can have the letters FU.
Yes, there you go. Of course, we have our own insurance problems here with universal health care that isn't universal. And it's not about health care. It's about taxation.
It's not universal at all. It's barely galactic, if anything.
Yeah. It's not even pervasive on our population as to who can get the coverage or what level of coverage they can get. But hey, we're not here to talk about those politics, I hope.
We could talk about them. I mean, if you feel like
we could, but I'm too old to risk a heart attack becoming irate about it.
You know, sometimes I find getting really irate and getting something out prevents heart attacks.
It can, especially on topics of bureaucracy. I've fought a lot of it. I've won on a rare occasion, but then the ramifications of that are just about as bad as the bureaucracy in the first place.
Yeah. They're a toxin, a cancer. And you can only benefit from bureaucracy if you don't have anything to do with it.
When the United States invaded Iraq in 2003, I said, well, it's not really because Saddam's an asshole, although he was. It's not really because they violated some 936 instances of the UN sanctions, it is because that's where bureaucracy was invented. And it should be destroyed.
Yeah. All right. Bureaucracy was invented in Mesopotamia, which is incidentally the reason why they make a mess of everything.
Yeah, pretty much. They also invented writing, according to most of the historians. But without writing, they're not historians because they don't like oral traditions.
Have you noticed that without writing, there would be no grammar Nazis?
Well, I don't know. I like good grammar. I like bad grammar. I just like communication. Open, honest communication.
Yeah. Which
the grammar Nazis don't really care about that.
No, they don't. It's like you'll say something really profound. Really profound. Something life-changing. An idea that will actually have an impact on the way somebody lives their life forever in perpetuity. And these people come in angry and criticize the incorrect positioning of the comma.
Yeah, I like commas. I'd use a comma after every word. Oh, sometimes I do, but just to piss them off.
Apparently, but, what was his name? John Key, he's the Prime Minister of New Zealand. Incidentally, mm-hmm. there was also recently Tony Abbott, the Prime Minister of Australia, was on primetime television, and there was actually a typo that said Prime Sinister. You wouldn't believe.
Oh, I'm so sorry I was on the wrong continent for that one.
I've been using that term for years, the Prime Sinister and scumbaggery. And every time somebody says Prime Sinister or scumbaggery, I always get emails from listeners telling me about this stuff. But check it out, the SD.
Yeah, your level of vindication just rose quite a bit, I think.
But. Yeah, well, you know, my name is Vinny, so vindication is implied.
There you go. It is.
Yeah.
There are a number of incidents without backing of historians that occurred in history that the historians don't want to talk about, and most of them involve sinister politicians. There is a very broad, not fine, but broad line between leaders and politicians. I don't care where you are in time or space, history, now, future, politicians suck. Leaders are hard to find. So there's my thought for the day.
And that is a really good closing thought. Conveniently, we have another 20 minutes.
Well, I'll try to come up with another one during that time.
Yeah.
But, and coming up with things is not exactly what I do. I synthesize information that already exists. In a few very rare cases, I go find new sites to investigate or whatnot. In one instance, I wrote a magazine article for Ancient American Magazine, and I invited readers, hey, if you know of a site that matches this description, stone walls near a body of water on a high hill, and set criteria for the type of site I was looking for. And oh, by the way, it has to be very old. Send me an email. And one guy did. And I recently took Dr. James Shears to that site so that he could investigate it. He specializes in surveying ancient sites to see if there are archaeoastronomy configurations on it or anything else that might indicate some kind of mathematical basis for a site. We haven't found a mathematical basis for this site, but he agrees that it is ancient and it is very strange.
How old does something have to be? How old does something have to be before it piques your interest? I mean, are we talking David Rockefeller old or George H.W. Bush old?
To pique my interest in my particular area of study right now, it would have to be before Columbus. So, you know, 540 years, give or take. 1,000 years is what is considered an ancient period of time.
Mm.
And there are plenty of those. This particular site has some 300-year-old trees growing into a stone wall. So that tells me it was before white settlers got here, give or take, at least to that part of Indiana. There were white settlers west of here, but not east of here. and this site is anomalous. That's the best word I can use right now. I don't know how to explain it. It doesn't exactly fit the description of a fortress. It might possibly have been a lookout slash signal spot. It's on a hill overlooking a river that was navigable for a stretch. And it fits into a network of communications, hills and man-made lookouts, stone towers. This one has stone supporting parts of the hill, possibly for defense, although it doesn't really fit that description well. It could have been if there was a palisade there. We'll have to do some digging, some further investigation to determine that. It has a cave that could have provided a steady stream of water, so it could have been like a water wheel to do work of some kind. But it's up on top of a steep hill, so it would have taken a lot of work to get goods up there to grind them and then take them back down. So that one doesn't work out all that well either. I don't know what's up with it, but we're going to try to figure it out. It's old, so that's why I like it. And it's a mystery. I like it even more.
Yeah. Hey, who doesn't like an old mystery? It was certainly enough for Scooby-Doo and the gang.
Yeah, for a couple decades they chased ghosts that weren't ghosts. They were always bad guys out for money.
Yeah.
Or something.
And incidentally, when you're investigating a hell of a lot of ancient sites around the world, that's exactly what you find. Bad guys chasing after money. All through the history books it is.
In one form of wealth or another has been the basis, the motive for expansion, for conquest, for whatever. It's always about wealth of some kind.
The accumulation of things. Now this occurs to me to be the psychopathic mindset, right?
To one degree or another, I concur. No. It's psychopathic. It's sociopathic because, well, let's go back to the Spanish Inquisition. They enslaved everybody in a new world and killed them or used them or, you know, just whatever for the benefit of the Spanish crown and a little bit for the church. Well, with the blessing of the church, because, well, they weren't Christian, therefore they didn't matter. Yeah. And it all goes back to that papal bull of 1452, which was entitled Terra Nullius, literally empty land, empty of Christians. If there were people there and they were not Christians, they were less than property. And you could have the land and you could do whatever you wanted with the people who were not Christians and therefore didn't matter.
Yep. Doesn't that sound like Iraq? Doesn't that sound like Afghanistan?
Well, there were a lot of Christians in both those places, but they weren't in power.
That's true.
Vietnam, the same way. Vietnam was missioned by the French Catholics a lot, but it was occupied by communists, a part of it was. Now it all is. So, that's an excuse. I mean, that's a reason.
Mm.
Eddie Izzard, you know who Eddie Izzard is, right? The comedian stand-up guy. He said, anybody with a flag can claim a country, especially if that country doesn't have its own flag.
Oh, was that Eddie Izzard, is it?
Well, one of many, but he puts it more comedic than most people do. That's what the first thing that Columbus did when he got to the West Indies was plant two flags. He planted his flag of Spain and the flag of the Catholic Church. Said a little ceremony and, hey, now we own it. Oh, you guys that are living here, too bad for you.
Yeah, it's like, it's a shame you didn't get here fast enough with that flag of yours, mate.
Yeah. Yeah.
They just take it. And have you noticed that what happens, this is happening just kind of on a micro as well as a macro level all throughout history and all throughout current society, isn't it? You know, psycho comes in, just takes what you have, and then if you say different, you try to defend or take it back, he kills you or destroys your life in some way. Isn't that happening all over the place?
Yes, still does. It takes a little different form, and it has a more sophisticated professional spin to it, but it is the same tactics.
Now, can I ask you to ponder this for a moment? What if, like, there's a psychopathic kind of sociopathic tendency that runs all the way through humanity, and it permeates out, it takes control by instinct, these people, of influential parts of society. They need entourages, they need fans, they need people to love them because they've got no love for anybody. So naturally they become doctors, lawyers, entertainers, politicians, etc.
Yeah, I knew that one again.
And as a result, the entire world is now controlled in a very real sense in all the major influential sectors of society by psychopaths or borderline psychopaths or psychopathic little helpers.
Who don't believe that they are those things.
Yeah.
That's self-delusion on top of the rest of it.
Yeah. So it's self-delusion brought on by psychopathic influence, right? It's like they can get you under a spell. And I think this is starting to come around for me because Carlos Castaneda talked about these, what were they called, snake demons or something like that, that can bind to people and take them over. It's like, it's not just human, these actions that these people are taking. It's devoid of what humans are meant to be. And what's ironic is when people look through human history and they see all the bad things that have been done by these psychopathic scumbaggery pieces of trash, they then blanket all of humanity as bad and they ignore all the really good, compassionate, loving, kind things that we do for each other every day.
Right, but they'll still parade out, you know, photographs or even living people like Mother Teresa and say, look, we have great people. Well, you don't have great people. They are great people, but you don't have them. You're using them. That's a big difference.
I think a person should be taken aside in a lot of cases, and you have a look at their actions and what they achieve. Like you take, let's say, Mother Teresa, for instance. One thing that she allegedly did was take care of a lot of people, and sure enough, some statistics are there to support that a lot of people got taken care of because of her actions. There's also those other group of people who were in intense pain, and her extreme belief in being around suffering bringing her closer to God, human suffering around her, bringing her closer to God. How does this sound? That she would actually force these bedbound people to stay in bed, not move, and get bed sores and all of this kind of thing, and actually prolong and increase their suffering in an attempt to get closer to God.
Yeah, that whole thing about closer to God is the reason I chose her as an example. You also have other, I hesitate to use the word, but it fits here, iconic people who have done good deeds, and those deeds have been exaggerated a great deal, but they're still the controllers of society, of the planet, use those people as a smokescreen for what's really causing the pain in the first place.
Yeah.
As an example.
Well, like you could hold up Martin Luther King and his assassination, and you remember it and all the great speeches and all the good things he did for the Black Civil Rights Movement. But you don't hear about Planned Parenthood taking out 80 million black unborn children.
Yeah.
You don't hear about a liquor shop, a gun shop, and a pawn shop next to each other in every major black urban center.
And almost universally owned by historically whites, but now it's moving into Asian owning those, or Near Easters.
Slavery didn't end, ladies and gentlemen, at the Civil War. It only began.
Well, it began on a larger segment of the population. And in fact, Civil War did not end legally at the end of the Civil War. The Emancipation Proclamation that Abraham Lincoln penned and signed did not carry the force of law. It's merely a proclamation. I proclaim it's evil and it should end. It wasn't a law. Before the war started, Lincoln, this is another period of American history that I really enjoy. Lincoln was in support of the 13th Amendment in an entirely different form that would have preserved slavery in the southern states as long as those southern states paid an inordinate amount of tax to the federal government. What? And yet he's considered the great emancipator. It wasn't about emancipation. It was about taxation. There's that whole wealth sociopathy thing again. He broke every tenet of the United States Constitution to win a war based on money.
And I think this comes to the most important realization in my life. Good people who are great leaders don't want power over other people. They want to empower other people.
Right.
Bad guys, on the other hand, who are great leaders, do the exact opposite. They need to have power over other people, and they convince them that giving up their own personal freedoms and power is a great idea.
Yeah. And Lincoln was very adept at that. As an example, during his campaign for Congress, before he was running for president, he sought the support of a guy in southern Illinois by the name of John Crenshaw. John Crenshaw held 715 slaves in Illinois, and he had special dispensation from the Illinois legislature, which was a non-slave state, to hold slaves in Illinois because, well, you couldn't get white folks to work those jobs, which was probably true, but still, Illinois, home of a number of presidents, including Lincoln and Obama, they have a very sketchy record of empowerment for the lowest parts of society. And Southern Illinois wanted to fight with the South.
The South shall rise again.
Pretty much. There were, in Indiana, as an example, during the Civil War, we had, I believe it was about 128,000 volunteers for the Union. And hey, we're proud of that. But what you don't find in many history books, and certainly not in any university history books, is that there were about 30,000 volunteers for the Confederacy from Indiana. And more than that, there were about 60,000 draft dodgers from Indiana.
Unbelievable.
Drafted into the Union Army. And they'd rather run and eat bugs than fight for the Union.
Do you recall the beginning of the film Braveheart, where he says, those historians will say I am a liar, for history is written by those who have hanged heroes?
Well, it is true, Julius Caesar being one of those. Julius Caesar tried to invade Great Britain in, I believe it was 53 BC, something like that. And he had a Roman armada of ships and troops. And the Welsh, because all of southern part of Great Britain at that time, southern part of the British Isles, I should say, were the Cymry, or Cymry. And they spoke Cymry, and they were the Cymry people, and they used a Colbran language, which he talked about in his journals. But he was able to escape the 700 ships they raised in 4 days. Therefore, it was a victory. And he was a great leader. Well, if he was that great a leader, why didn't he just convince him to become part of the Roman Empire? If he were truly a great leader, it's a matter of persuasion rather than conquest.
I forget the name of which Roman leader it was. It may have even been Caesar, but they had no men around them. You know how some people have yes men all around them? One Roman leader specifically had no men, like people to keep them in check and that kind of thing. And then incidentally, they all hatched a conspiracy amongst themselves, all as no men, to kill him and take over.
Sure. Yeah, Julius Caesar was stabbed by every member of the Roman Senate.
You're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. Don't become a leader, folks. It's just not worth it.
don't become a politician for sure. And we're getting ready for tomorrow is an election day here for a minor local offices and what they call a primary election here before they go to a general election in the fall.
All right.
Midterm. It's not a presidential election, but a few senators, congressmen, et cetera. Well, all the congressmen are running for reelection this fall. And it's a circus. I don't care how you look at it. Even on the local races, it's a circus. Even the sheriff's race here is a circus.
When you said running for office, an image popped into my mind of, you know, when you come into the kitchen late at night and you turn the light on, you see a cockroach or something scuttle into the darkness again. That's what image kind of came into my mind. You know, all of a sudden the lights are on and these little cockroaches are out for everybody to see, and then they're scuttling away to get into position so that they can infect you with disease and eat away the goodness of your society like termites do a good table.
And ruin all of your stored foodstuffs.
Yeah, and your children's future. Rick Osman was my very special guest, ladies and gentlemen. Don't forget to check out the Ancient America Conference on July 12th, 2014. You can get that on Facebook there. And also, Rick, you have websites of some note, don't you?
A couple of them. AncientAmerica.com, which is not the same as AncientAmericanMagazine.com, but we kind of interact. I also administer and contribute to another one that some of your listeners might like, TheHollowEarthInsider.com, which is also named THEI.US, same site, different names. And it's more the conspiracy stuff than you might think about Hollow Earth theory. So I have fun with those.
Yeah, in fact, I'd like to... you could probably fill up another interview gap with an entire Hollow Earth episode as well, couldn't you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Pretty sure.
All right. Well,
cover it all in a couple hours.
No, you can't. You can't. That's why they're called episodes.
Yes.
Rather than the whole ball of wax. Rick Osman, ladies and gentlemen, ancientamerica.com, ancientamericamagazine.com. And which was the Hollow Earth one again, sorry?
TheHollowEarthInsider.com.
Earthinsider.com. All right. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Bear in mind, this is a listener-supported broadcast. So if you are listening to this and you are already a regular subscriber through the PayPal, the PayPal email has changed to gorillamedia77@gmail.com. The details there are on the homepage, and simply cancel your old subscription and just subscribe again with the PayPal button on the page. All the things have been changed. PayPal does this every year. They just kind of like freeze one of my PayPal accounts and ask for documentation that I don't have, like proof that I'm some kind of charitable organization and everything like that, which I never claim because it's an urgent account, and they don't answer any of your emails, and they always use the word repetitively. You know what the word is, don't you? Unfortunately. You've had an employer tell you that?
Yeah, it has a twin, denied.
Yeah, yeah. See, that's the thing. Bureaucracy can't be reasoned with. It's kind of like the Terminator in that way, you know?
Yeah. And got to reprogram them.
People don't get it, okay? There are only two things certain in life. Death and taxes. Okay?
That's right.
And people haven't figured out that it's the taxes that's killing you.
They do coexist well, seems like.
You know, it's not a chicken and egg scenario, ladies and gentlemen. There is a clear causal relationship, in my opinion. Okay.
Certainly.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you. I've enjoyed this a great deal. Hope we can do it again.
I hope we can, too. And just hold on the line there after we get off here. We'll see you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen.